So back in Luke, you probably gathered that from everything that's happened so far. So we're back in Luke, excited to be there. As Michael said, ever since Grace Church started, we've spent some of the year looking at Luke. We love to spend some of the year looking at one of the Gospels, because the Gospels are where you just get to see Jesus just live out his life. Just, this is what he does. These are the things he said. And it gives you a moment to just pause and go, okay, these are all the things that I had already thought about Jesus. How do I make sense of this? Like, we all have our ideas of who Jesus was. Some of them based on the Bible, some of them based on history, some of them based on TV, some of them based on all kinds of things. But one of the great things we get to do in the Gospels is just look at what he's done and just go, okay, who was he? Why did he say those things? What was actually sitting underneath that? And so we just want to remind ourselves about what Luke is. Luke, at the beginning, takes the time to tell us how he went about writing this book. Well, like, what is Luke? Why should we believe this account of Jesus' life? And Luke says that what he did was he went and he spoke to eyewitnesses. So he went round to different people and he spoke to them, people who'd spent time with Jesus, and he just, in essence, interviewed them and heard their stories. The stories of the things that they'd seen, the conversations they'd had, the things that they'd heard about Jesus. But he didn't just go and talk to all these people and then go, right, blah, there's everything I've heard about Jesus. We get told he wrote an ordered account. So he wrote an account which was a selection of those stories about Jesus' life designed to teach certain truths. And so there's specific emphases in Luke's gospel. He has things that he's really interested in. And a few of the big ideas that Luke is interested in are as follows. Number one, Luke is passionately committed to communicating that Jesus was for all people. Okay, Jesus didn't come just for the Jewish people. He didn't come just for one nation or for one part of society. Luke's special emphasis is on making clear Jesus came for everyone. So whoever you are here today, whatever background you come from, however much you know about Jesus or don't know about Jesus, however much you think, oh, Jesus could have nothing to do with me, Luke's passion is to make everybody who reads this see that Jesus came for them, that Jesus has something to say to them. Okay, so that's one of Luke's kind of special emphases. A second emphasis of Luke is he has a really strong focus on money throughout his gospel. So if you were to look through Luke, you'll see again and again the issue of money is raised. Jesus teaches more about money in Luke's gospel. You see money being referred to a lot in the conversations that other people have had. So Luke also has a very, very strong focus on money in his gospel. So they're kind of a couple of the focuses you'll see. But as we join it here, as you'll have seen in the video, what Luke is committed to helping us see here is what is it that Jesus came to do? Because for 11 chapters pretty much, then we've been told that Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. So he's got his face set in a certain direction. He's going somewhere. He wants to get somewhere for a particular reason. He's headed somewhere. Single-mindedly, he's on his way to Jerusalem. And he said a number of times that the reason he's going to Jerusalem is because when he goes to Jerusalem, he's going to be killed. Now, it seems a slightly odd reason to go somewhere. It's not a normal reason people give. I'm going to head this place. Why? Because then they can kill me. Like, that's not a normal thing people talk about. But Jesus has been very clear about this. I'm going to Jerusalem, and I'm going there so that the chief priests and teachers of the law will be able to kill me. But on the journey, two things are happening that are kind of playing into that story. And they're making it, on the one hand, much more likely, but on the other hand, quite difficult. The two things that are happening are this. The powers, the religious authorities specifically, are getting increasingly hostile towards Jesus. Jesus is again and again calling them out. He's calling them out in public. And people with power and people with authority don't like being called out in public because it threatens their power and it threatens their control. So they're getting increasingly hostile toward Jesus. And they're getting to the point where they're like, we just have to get rid of him. We don't care how we do it, what it looks like, we have to get rid of him. So that's happening, which makes it very likely. But the problem is that at the same time, Jesus is getting this really strong kind of grassroots support. He's really popular with the ordinary people. So as we saw in the story, as he goes into Jerusalem, there's crowds and crowds of people around him, worshipping him, shouting out praises to him. And that makes it difficult because the religious leaders who want to get rid of him are also then worried about, well, what will all these other people who seem to be following him, seem to be into him, what are they going to do about it? And so that's what's been going on really for a few chapters since Jesus has been in Jerusalem. And then in Luke 22, we see this kind of switch where we see the way that the religious leaders find to get by that problem. How are they going to deal with the problem of all these people and Jesus being so popular? So Luke 22 verse 1 to 6, it's a small passage. It's like a paragraph at the bottom of page, of the first column of page 1057. So grab a Bible, let me read it to you, and then we'll have a look at this. So Luke 22, 1 to 6. Now the festival of unleavened bread, called the Passover, was approaching. And the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some way to get rid of Jesus, for they were afraid of the people. Then Satan entered Judas, called Iscariot, one of the 12. And Judas went to the chief priests and the officers of the temple guard and discussed with them how he might betray Jesus. They were delighted and agreed to give him money. He consented and watched for an opportunity to hand Jesus over to them when no crowd was present. You see, this is the turning point. You see what they've managed to sort out here? What they've done is they've got one of Jesus' inner circle to hand Jesus over to them at a point where there's no crowd around. How do we get by this problem of he's really popular with all these people and they might all kick off if we suddenly arrest him? How do we get by him? Well, we need to do it in secret. So what we need is we need someone inside in Jesus' inner circle who can ensure that we come at a time where there aren't other people around, where we can easily identify him and where we can arrest him quietly and avoid that kind of mob explosion that they're worried about. So that's their plan. That's how they're going to deal with this. And of course, what sits in the middle of it is the sort of classic betrayal story. You know, people still talk about people as Judases. This is the story of a betrayal. One of Jesus' closest friends, one of the 12 people who's been with Jesus throughout his ministry, is going to hand him over, and not just hand him over like to any old thing, hand him over to the most horrific torture and death. That's what's going to happen here. That's how they're going to make it happen. But what I want us to think about this week is what leads to that turn of events. What factors play into Judas making this decision and the story going this way? And I guess underneath this is going to sit the question of, like, how do we think the world works? Like, how do we think decisions get made? How do we think things happen in the world? I wonder for you, kind of, you're coming here this week. You'll have had lots of different ideas about how you think the world works, and you'll live a certain way because of the way the world works. So you might think, I am largely autonomous. I kind of make my own decisions. I am ruler of my life, and that's how the world works. I make decisions and things happen. Sometimes I make terrible decisions and bad things happen. But sometimes I make good decisions and good things happen, because largely the way the world works is I'm in control and I make decisions and then the world pans out a certain way. And so what we do is we spend our lives thinking through, okay, how do I make good decisions? How do I make the right decisions? Okay, how's this going to play out? That's how the world works. People make decisions, things happen, that's it, isn't it? So you might be coming here and thinking, yeah, that's how the world works. That's how I approach my life anyway. I just think about it, make decisions, and assume that things are going to go a certain way. Now, there's another extreme to that, which I guess some people in the room will see at. So some of us will be kind of more towards that side, but there's another extreme to that, which is actually, I'm largely just a victim of circumstances. Like, I'm not in control. Like, stuff just happens. And I don't know why it happens, I don't know how it happens, but I just have to kind of roll with the punches, as it were. I've just got to kind of go with it and try and find my route. And I might be going this way, but then all these things are going to happen, and who knows where I'll end up. No point planning, no point thinking about it, no point making decisions, really, because I've just got to kind of deal with whatever life's going to throw at me. Is that the way you kind of think the world works? And then there's other questions to ask in that. So as we're thinking about how the world works, am I basically a good person who's going to generally do good things and therefore I can just go with what I feel like? Or am I basically a bad person who's basically going to do bad things and therefore I need to be self-controlled and disciplined about the things I do? That's going to have an impact on how you think the world works. Kind of, how do I go about making decisions? Can I trust my decisions? Am I likely to want to do good things, or am I more likely to want to do bad things? As you kind of look through your life, as you look back, maybe let's not talk about life, because life's too big, isn't it? We can never think about it. As you look through, like, the last month, how do you make decisions? Think about the decisions you've made over the last month. How have you made those decisions? What have your kind of assumptions been? Have your assumptions been that basically I'll make good decisions, and so I just need to think about it and I'll make good decisions? And has it been based on, if I make good decisions, good things will happen? Or has it been more kind of, oh, well, you know, I'll make this decision, but who knows how it's going to turn out? No point thinking about it too much because it'll probably all go wrong anyway. Like, is it more like that? You see, we'll all have a view of how the world works and how things happen. But what I think we see in this account of the betrayal of Jesus is we get some insights into some kind of powerful factors that are going to influence us as we make decisions. And they're actually going to influence the world and the way it pans out for us. And what I want us to do, whatever you come here believing, however your normal approach to thinking about decisions, thinking about the world is, what I want you to do is to think, does the kind of influence of these factors, does that ring true in the world around you? So do you see these kind of forces playing an important role in the way the world pans out? And then let's go kind of more personal. How about in my life? Do I see these forces influencing the way I think and the way I make decisions and the kind of direction that my life goes? Because I think in this section, there may be more, but I think there's four clear forces at work here that lead to the story taking this turn of events. There's four forces that are at play influencing people in this. And all of us, I would suggest, need to be aware of the power of these four forces, because all of these forces will influence you in some way. Okay, so this is what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna run through the four forces that I think are at work. I'm gonna help us to think through how can we be aware of those. How can we think about the influence they might have? So let's get to it. The first is religion. Okay, religion is a powerful force in society and in your life. It's been a powerful force throughout history. And in a more secular society like ours, then it's not uncommon for people to point this out. So people are regularly saying, well, religion, that's the thing that causes wars. That's the kind of thing that has led the history of the world to take a certain direction. It's because people are religious. And as you say that, then there's a fair bit of evidence that would make you go, kind of makes a lot of sense. So you think about the terrorist attacks we've seen over the last decades, the last years, even the last months. And a lot of those have had religious or sometimes kind of non-religious, but very clearly ideological roots about the things that people believe. And so it's easy to see why people would say religion's got a lot to answer for in the world. It really has. And it's been argued, I think, kind of well by many of the kind of high prominent atheists of our time, that the problem with religion is that it turns conflict into this kind of transcendental battle. It turns a conflict into battles between absolute good and absolute ill. That's what it does. That's the problem with religion. So whereas in other things you might be able to negotiate, to talk through a circumstance, to think through, okay, how do we kind of de-escalate this? If you're saying, no, this is God's will and I have to do it, there's no real compromise to that. There's no way to row back from it. This is a battle between good and evil and I have to be on the side of the good. No compromise. In short, religion can be used to feed fanaticism. That's what it can do. It can be, and that fanaticism can then be harnessed to pretty much motivate any course of action. So it can cause incredible good or it can lead to incredible evil. And the reason I raise this at this point is because who are the people who are the most committed to taking this person, Jesus, who is completely innocent, and having him wrongly convicted and having him tortured and then crucified? Well, it's the religious leaders. They're looking for any way to kill him. And they should have been the people who are pointing people towards God. They should have been the people who are saying, here, come and see God, come and hear him teach. But instead, what they're doing is they're planning to kill God himself. That's what is going on here. You see, religion doesn't protect us from evil. In fact, it can be used to foster evil within us. So here's the first kind of force that I want us to be aware of. The power of religion. Just beware of it. Beware of people who say, this is what God wants you to do. or who claim God's authority to instruct. Now, we must allow God to speak for himself. And he's promised to do that in two ways. Two clear ways God's promised to speak for himself. One is through his Bible. So God said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the accounts of Jesus' life. I'm going to take these words from people who saw him and who spent time with him, these words from people who heard from him directly. I'm going to put them down in writing so that you can hear what I say clearly in black and white on a page. So that's one way we can hear God speak. And the second way that God has promised that we will hear him speak is through his Spirit. God himself will talk to you through his Spirit. Sometimes God will want to say something specific to you, and he will say that through his Spirit. Sometimes he will want to help you to understand part of the Bible that you've been struggling with, and he'll do that through his Spirit. God will speak to you directly. So beware those people who say, this is what God is saying. You see, it's perfectly possible that these religious leaders had allowed their religion to justify their desire to kill the Son of God. I mean, it's actually not that far-fetched to think through how they'd have got there. Because if they are convinced that he is a blasphemer, he is somebody who is claiming to be God, who is not God, and if they convince themselves that this is now leading many, many people away from the true God, this is now leading them away from him. And as such, as he's doing that, he's actually mocking God and he's opposing God and he's leading people away, then it's not hard to see, well, this person's dangerous. And they might say, look, we've tried talking to him and we've tried calling him out and we've tried all these things, but he won't respond to any of them. So now we just have to get rid of him any way possible. And the only way we can see it is through having him crucified. Very possible that they had, with their religious understanding, had got to a point where their religion made them see this as the right way. In fact, it's pretty much what the chief priest says when at the very beginning when talking about Jesus being killed. He says it's better for one man to die than for many. So his argument is, look, we've got to get rid of this person because it's for the good of all these people who we're here to care for. See, religion can feed incredible evil. When you think this is what God is saying, and you just go with that, it's a dangerous place to be in. And so the question is, how do you protect yourself from that? If we are people who genuinely believe that God does speak to us and he does call us to do certain things, and we want to obey God, because why would you not, then how do you protect yourself from that danger that actually you use it to justify evil? You use it to justify things you shouldn't. How do we check that we're actually listening to God and not just our own religion and our own beliefs? Well, Jesus again and again says that we know a tree by its fruit. How do you know who you're listening to? How do you know whether the religious beliefs that you're kind of going along with, how do you know whether they're good or not? How do you know whether you're not just under the force of powerful religion or whether you're actually listening to the one true God? Well, let me suggest this. Jesus says the fruit of listening to God, the fruit of his Spirit, is love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and self-control. And he says more things, but there's a few. So here's the test. Does your religion, is what you believe about God, is what you believe about how the world works and how you make decisions and all those things, does it lead you to being more loving, more joyful, kinder, more patient, to exercising better self-control? Is that what it leads to? Because if it's not, then something's gone horribly wrong in your religion. You're now just subject to the forces of religion. You're not hearing and listening to and obeying the voice of God anymore. If your religion makes you exclusive and miserable and irritable and unkind and irrational, then you're in danger of allowing the power of religion to be used to grow evil in you, which it has been done throughout history. The power of religion has been used to grow evil in people. You're in danger of allowing that to happen rather than allowing God to grow the new life that he intends for you. So beware the force of religion. It's a powerful influencing factor in our society, in our world, and in our lives. So we've got to be aware of that force. But of course, there's something else going on with religious leaders here, isn't there? I mean, it's probably the more obvious thing. And it was talked about in that video we watched earlier. Because these are not just any old religious leaders. This isn't like the local, like me equivalent in Israel. Like, it's not that. These are like the chief priests. These are like the people who, in that society, really ruled the day. They set the laws for the society. Yeah, they were under Roman law, but in terms of Jewish people, that these were the kind of the head of the Jewish society. These are people of real power and influence. And as many people have observed, the problem with power is that it has this tendency to corrupt. You know, this is what people have said throughout history. The problem with is you give people a bit of power, and they tend to not be able to handle it very well. You see, they may well have justified what they were doing with religious beliefs, but it's clear throughout the account of Jesus' life that the religious leaders were worried that Jesus was threatening their power. They wanted people to listen to them, but now they were listening to Jesus. They wanted people's respect and adulation, but here was Jesus criticizing them and in public, and people were listening. He seemed to have no regard for their status in society. And the more people who listened to Jesus, the more undermined their position came. You see, so we've got to be aware of the power and influence of religion over our lives. We've also got to be aware of the kind of force and influence that power can have over us. Because the human condition, ever since the beginning of time, is that we want to rule. Go back to the very first story in the Bible, the story of Adam and Eve and how they fell. What was the problem? The problem was that God says, I'm going to rule and you're going to rule under me. And we said, no, we want to rule and we don't want you. That's the human condition. The human condition is we don't want an authority figure sitting above us. We want to say, I'm going to rule. I'm going to have the power. I'm going to be in control. Sin. It is fundamentally humanity's rejection of God's rule. It's that decision that we're going to rule without him. And since that point, human beings have been addicted to power. We're just addicted to it. We can't get enough of it. And you might think, that's not me. That's not me. I've got no power, you might be sitting there. You might be sitting there thinking, I can see how that's a problem for kind of big high flyers and powerful people in society, but it's not me. It's not where I am. But let me just suggest a few ways you might see it in yourself. Okay, it might be that in your workplace, you are committed to your position. And you can't cope when someone fails to recognize it. You know, when that person who like tells you what to do and you go, wait a minute, I'm here and you're here in the organization. You just can't cope with it. Feels like an insult. Kind of threatens our status. Don't you know who I am? Kind of a big deal around here. You know, that kind of thing. Maybe it's that. Maybe you just feel slighted if people don't recognize your position and the power that should go with that. Or maybe it's not in the workplace. Maybe it's in your marriage. Maybe in your marriage, you're liable to fly off the handle if you don't get your own way. You just love to control. I have to get my own way in the marriage. That's how it's got to work. Or maybe you're not that guy. You're not the person who's likely to fly off the handle, but you're just going to manipulate. You're going to use everything you can to make sure you get your own way. Maybe you're going to lie. Maybe you're going to do whatever you need to get your own way in that. Maybe it's in friendships where you're only interested in having people around you who will massage your ego and who you can influence and control. We can see our desire for power in all kinds of relationships. But here's the warning of the section. And the warning of the section is quite clear. And I found it really helpful in thinking through kind of how do I relate to power in my life. Here's the warning. When you've got it, the danger is you'll do anything to hold on to it. That's the problem. Once you've tasted a little bit of power, you really don't want to let it go. Because that's the problem here. It's not that the chief priests are necessarily after more power. They're not going, wait a minute, how do we kind of raise ourselves up in society? They just feel threatened with the power they've got. And once they've had it, they can't imagine what it would be like not having it. Once we have a little bit of status in somewhere, a little bit of influence, just a little bit of power, but once we've got it, we'll do anything we can to hold on to it. And the reality is, people do extreme things to protect the power that they've got. History is full of people who've got embroiled in a whole host of things simply because they were committed to holding on to their position. It's the story of abusive marriages, of corrupt politicians, of disgraced religious leaders. All of these stories kind of are the same. Something comes along and threatens their position. And so they lie and they bully. Maybe they lie again. Then they need to cover it up. And then, you know, they've got to silence someone. It looks extreme, but the warning is here. And you'll be surprised at the things you will do just to maintain a little bit of power and influence in your life. So beware. When you're making decisions, you're going to be influenced by the force of religion in your life. You're going to be influenced by the force of power in your life. That desire for it. That longing to hold on to the power you've got. That little bit of control that you think you need. Two powers. Religion and power. Can power be a power? I don't know. Two forces. Third, money. You see, that's another force that's at play in this bit of Luke. And he's already had a lot to say about it in the Gospel, as I said at the start. It's the power of money which the chief priests mobilize to ensure that Judas hands them over. See, this is what people do, isn't it? People who want something to happen, they offer money, because that's a really good way to make things happen. If I want someone to do something, I offer a certain amount of money, and as long as the amount of money is right, then you'll find someone who'll do it for that amount of money. Whatever this thing may be. That's why in businesses, people offer bonuses. You want your employees to behave a certain way, and we've learned that money is a really good way to incentivize a certain kind of behavior. So we offer a bonus. We say, well, here's your bonus if you do X, Y, and Z. And some people go away and do X, Y, and Z because money's a powerful force. It's why people will make huge lifestyle changes based on money. Why we'll change jobs and change where we live and change all kinds of things simply because someone goes, well, it's a better job, it's more money. Really powerful force. It'll influence your life in unbelievable ways. Your life will take a certain journey, and along that way, a number of the decisions you'll be made will have been the primary force at play, will have been money. That would have been the number one force that was influencing that decision. And the problem with that is, at its worst, money will make us consider things that we would never consider if there wasn't a financial kind of offer with it. You'll just consider things that without the kind of money factor, you wouldn't have ever considered doing. Let me give some examples. We're much more likely to lie when money's at stake. So I don't know. Say I've smashed a window. I'm much more likely to deny it if I think I'm going to have to pay the bill for that window. Whereas if it's at home and I think, well, my parents will probably pay, I'm more likely to own up. I'm more likely to lie where there's a financial incentive to lying. We're much more likely to lie to a tradesman when we think that'll mean that they give us a lower quote. You know, oh, well, this other person came and they offered us that just to knock the quote down. We're much more likely to do that because there's a financial incentive to it. Things that we never consider doing under normal circumstances, we suddenly think, well, I could do that. It might save me 500 quid. You can see in loads of ways, families are much more likely to quarrel about money than many other things in the world. And at the extreme level, people constantly tell us that every war is about money and every act of violence is about money. Like, you can just see it on a global scale, the influence that money has. Beware the power of money over the decisions you'll make in your life. Maybe for us, we experience the power of money as we find ourselves feeling more and more important because of the money we have. Maybe we have quite a lot of money and we think it makes us more important. And money has now become our status and we are under its power. That's who I am. My money kind of marks me out as somebody. If I didn't have that, who would I be? Now we're reliant on it. If we don't have that, I'm just a nobody. Maybe for us, we experience the power of money by being obsessed with the accumulation of it. Maybe we work every hour available to get more money. And because of that, we fail to be the spouses or the sons or the daughters or the parents or the friends that we should be because of the power of money over our lives. Maybe we always put work first and money first, and as such, God is forced to take a back seat. Work dominates our time. And so meeting with Christians, praying, reading my Bible, well, that always comes second. I'll do it, but if I'm going to take a financial hit for doing it, absolutely no chance. Maybe money just dominates our thought space. All of our time is spent worrying about money, working out how can we make the money work, dealing all, and leaving no space for meditating on God and his word and who he is, on reflecting on all that he's done for us. Maybe we experience the power of money by allowing it to dominate our hopes and dreams. What are your hopes and dreams in life? How many of them are related to money? Maybe it's all we ever think about. It's the thing which we think is going to sort out our lives. Maybe every week we simply have to buy a lottery ticket because it just gives us that thing to dream for. I often say buying a lottery ticket has very little to do with buying the chance to winning. It's buying the opportunity to dream for a week. That's what you're paying for. You're paying £1 for a week's dreaming, and it feels quite good quite a lot of the time. Like, here's £1, I can dream for a week. What would I do with that money? We all know we're very unlikely to win it, but that's why we do it. Because money has become our hope and our dream. We're under its power. Maybe we are under the power of money because we're terrified of losing it. Terrified of losing it. We worry about having enough, and losing money is the most stressful thing we could imagine. And maybe that fear leads us to questionable morality, lying, being economical with the truth, whatever you want to call it. Maybe it leads to a lack of generosity in your life. Money's a powerful force in the world. It's a powerful force in your life. It will set the direction of your life in loads of different ways. That's what happens here. Judas is incentivized to take a certain course of action because of the power of money. Religion plays its part in influencing the decisions people make. The desire for power plays its part in influencing the way the decisions people make. That people's love of money plays a part in influencing the decisions people want to make. But there's something else going on here, isn't there? Verse 3. It might be. When we had a planning meeting on Monday, which was really good, I'd encourage people, if they can make it along to them, to come along. I find it so helpful in terms of thinking through what's going on in this passage. And the thing that jumped out to all of us in it, in verse 3, was that bit. Then Satan entered Judas. And you think, what's all that about? What's this Satan entering a person about? Like, it just sounds weird, doesn't it? Like, I get, okay, money, yeah, I understand money. I've had money. I kind of know how it works. I've understood power. I understand religion. But Satan entering someone, what's going on here? It's not the kind of thing we often talk about. And when we do, I guess what goes in our mind is something kind of clearly supernatural. What we imagine is that Satan entering someone just leads to kind of irrational evil. It's like, yeah, Satan's in that person. They're just going to do terrible things, probably with red eyes. Like, that's what the kind of images it conjures up for us. But I want you to see that what follows here is actually just everyday evil. What follows here isn't some sort of supernatural irrationality. That's not what happens here. Satan enters him, and then what happens? Well, normal evil happens. People with long-standing beliefs use those beliefs to justify whatever they want. People do that all the time. A person who feels let down by a person who he's followed decides that he's had enough of him and he's going to betray him. Leaders who feel threatened by a rival decide they've got to get rid of him. And a man is willing to hand over a friend for the promise of money. That's what happens. Nothing weird. Nothing that you go, man, I can't see how that could have happened. Just normal, everyday evil. It's really important that we allow this to influence the way that we think the world works. The world does not work in a way where we have ordinary, sort of material human evil and then these kind of out there spiritual, off the scale evil kind of acts. That's not how the world works. Now, the Bible says that people, all of us, are simultaneously physical and spiritual beings at the same time. All mixed up together. There isn't a physical me and a spiritual me. There is one me. I am physical and spiritual. That's how the Bible says that people work. And because of that, there are physical and spiritual realities all coexisting together all of the time. So in the ordinary schemes of men, Satan is also involved to work out his purposes. As the forces of money and religion and power at work, so are all the forces of evil looking to make the most of every opportunity to oppose God's good plan for his world, to bring death and destruction and guilt where God would bring life and rescue and forgiveness. That's how the world works. The fourth thing we need to beware of is spiritual forces of evil in our world. Not in a weird way, we just need to be aware that they're out there. Mixed in with our own brokenness, with our selfishness, with our own destructiveness, is a spiritual battle where forces of evil are seeking to tempt us, to harm us, to use us to oppose God and to hurt other people. That's what's going on all the time in your life. Yes, you're selfish. Yes, you're going to be broken, you're going to make bad decisions. Yes, you're going to be influenced by all these other factors. But all the time alongside that, there are evil spiritual forces trying to tempt you to do those things. Trying to point you in that direction, trying to push you to oppose God, to hurt other people. And so when it comes to resisting evil, don't think all I need to do is master money and power and religion. Because as you do that, you're also trying to fight a spiritual battle which will be tempting you and burdening you and trying all it can to make you stop fighting in despair. That's how the Bible says the world works. And I asked at the start, and this is what I want to come back to just as we start drawing this all together, to how do you think the world works? Now, that's how the Bible says the world works. The Bible says there's all these forces that are playing a part in the way you make decisions. There's the power of money, and there's the power of religion, and there's the power of power. But there's also this spiritual element going on. Like, how do you think the world works? Because whenever I come back to thinking about Christianity, whenever I get to that point where I just think, can I really believe in God? Like, does it really make any sense? I just look at that and go, that describes the world that I see all around me. In the world I see all around me, I see those forces at play, but I also see evil. I see more than just those forces at play. And when I look at my own heart, I see the same thing. I see that I'm influenced by money and the desire for it. I see that the force of power and the desire for it is influencing my decisions. I can see all these things going on, but I also can see that the battle's hard. That I find it harder than I ought. Sometimes I do things that just seem destructive and I don't even know why. You see, that's the world that makes sense to me. That's the world that I live in. When I was at university, I went to see Tony Benn speak. Now, I don't know how many of you know who Tony Benn is. He is a sort of, I suppose, left-leaning, might be an understatement, politician. He was kind of a fairly significant figure on the left, famously smoked a pipe that's kind of the image you always have of him. And as I was there, I went to see him in a theatre in Sheffield, and I was in the crowd, and he was sat there on the stage smoking his pipe. And he was talking about, the first half was basically him talking, and the second half was a Q&A. And I found it fascinating, because at that point, I kind of was interested in those sort of things. I still am, but just kind of don't exercise that interest in quite the same way. And the first half, when he was talking, he talked about five powers that are at play in the work, five sources of power that influence the way society works. That was basically all he did for the first half, and then he just did Q&A, which was just whatever people wanted to talk about. And the five sources of power that he talked about, I'm doing this from memory, so they might not be exactly right, but it was like 20 years ago or whatever. But here's what I think they were. The first is political power. There's political power in the world. These are politician people who get the power to make laws and to kind of set the kind of direction of society in a lot of different ways. So you've got political power, that's one source of power. You've got technology as a second source of power. The ability of technology to influence and to be used to move society in a certain direction. And you can see that all the way. So you can see that through the way people have used the technology of social media to influence the way people think, or the technology of surveillance to be able to control what people say, or the technology of nuclear weaponry to be able to impose certain ways of viewing the world and organizing society on other nations. You can kind of see it. So you've got political power, you've got technology as a source of power, you've got military power. So sometimes just force, just physical force can create can give people power. I'm stronger than you, therefore I'm more powerful than you. Okay, so you've got that. The fourth, you've got kind of ideologies as the kind of fourth source of power. So religion, strong ideologies can be used, harnessed to influence the way people think, to dominate societies. And you see that in numerous countries around the world as a particular way of viewing the world. For us, Western liberalism, for other countries, Islamic extremism, is used as a source of power to influence the way people think. And the fifth was information, the flow of information. Information gives people power. If I can control the information you have, then I control the way you think. I control what you think is going on in the world and how you're going to react to that. And you see that from state propaganda to the power of those in the media who are able to influence the way people think. So there were the kind of five sources of power that he talked about. There you go, you're getting a bit of Tony Benn free. But as you run through those, as I was sat there listening to this, there's a bit of me that just thinks, like, what hope then do I actually have? Like, what hope does the average punter have when playing in a world where those powers are all being harnessed to influence us? Where people are controlling the information that I have, and people are setting laws and cultural kind of decisions about the way we go, and people are using military might to control the way people live, and people, like, what hope do I have to be able to, like, make any sort of autonomous decisions in that? I'm hopelessly outgunned against those powers. I can't suddenly see other information to the information that people are constantly feeding me. It's there. What can I do? Am I forever destined to be ruled over and controlled by those powers? And that's how it can seem as we look at the powers that we've looked at today. We're just hopelessly outgunned. Because again and again, we see the power of religion or our cultural ideologies. We see it influencing and controlling us. I think a certain way, and therefore I live a certain way. And some of that makes sense, and some of it doesn't really. Again and again, we see the temptation to seek power and the fear of losing it controlling our actions. Again and again, I can see how money controls my priorities and the actions I take. And there are those times where I'm keenly aware that there's a spiritual battle sitting underneath that, which leads me to do things that I regret and to hurt myself and to hurt those around me. What hope is there for us when you've got those powers all there influencing us? Well, the hope for us is actually found right here in the betrayal and death of Jesus. That's where your hope is. Because here we see all those forces being exercised to their maximum in all-out war against humanity. That's what's actually going on here. And where Judas fails, he can't stand up against those powers. The power of Satan and money and power and religion, it's all too strong for him. And he fails. Where the chief priests fail, where every one of us fails, Jesus succeeds. That's what's going on here. Because money is powerless over him. He spends his life never trying to acquire it, never being ruled over by it. He's not bound by religious tradition or by convention. He doesn't allow the cultural ideologies of the day to influence what he says. He speaks truth at all points. Power doesn't convince him that the thing he has to do is just hold on to it. In fact, we're told that he willingly gives it up. He gives up the power of God himself to become a baby, don't get much more powerless than that, to become someone being nailed to a cross. I mean, that's probably the one thing more powerless than a baby. And when Satan and all the forces of evil throw everything they have at him, he endures it, and he emerges victorious over all of them at the cross. That's where your hope is. Because you're outgunned by those powers. You can't match them. But more than that, at the cross, he also acts as our representative. Because you see, ultimately, all these forces we are subject to, they lead us to one place. They lead us to death and separation from God. That's what they're trying to do. But as Jesus stands over them, untarnished, undefeated by them, he says to these powers, all the death and all the separation that you're demanding from people, I now take on myself. You no longer rule So you no longer get to demand their lives. Your power has met its match. So you can no longer keep them. No, God who made them and loved them, he is now their God. And Jesus' victory becomes our victory. So let's wrap it up. Beware these forces. Don't be surprised when you find yourself hopelessly outmatched by the powers of evil, by the lure of money, by our desire for evil, by those deep-set beliefs which we see inside us and all around us. You are outmatched. That's why you feel outmatched. But Jesus is not. Here, as all these powers are involved in conspiring against him, this is actually just the prelude to his victory, through which he declares us free from their power. So what do we do now? We fight against them, knowing that one day, through Christ, we will share in the victory that he has already secured. Let me pray for us.